Kia ora, and welcome to the New Zealand History Podcast Channel, where you will find talks on Aotearoa New Zealand history, culture, and society. These talks are organised by Manatū Taonga, the Ministry for Culture and Heritage, with the support of the Alexander Turnbull Library. They are recorded live, either via Zoom or in person at Te Puna Mātauranga o Aotearoa, the National Library of New Zealand.
Kia ora te marino, kia whakapapa pounamu te moana. Hei huarahi mā tātou I te rangi nei, aroha atu, aroha mai, tātou I a tātou katoa, hui e, taiki. Kia ora everybody, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā tātou katoa. Ko Imogene Kelly Takawingwa, he pau he tori mātua, ata ata rongo ahau. I'm Senior Audio-Visual Historian at Manatū Taonga, Ministry for Culture and Heritage. Ngā mihi nui ki te atiawa ki te whanganui atara, taranaki whānui me Ngāti Toa Rangatira hoki. Ngā mihi nui to the library staff who always do such a fabulous job of making us welcome, including Mark, who does the tech. The series is developed in conversation with the library, in particular between the wonderful Joan McCracken, working with the fabulous and very tenacious Kate Jordan, my fellow historian at Manatū Taonga. Dr. Sibel Locke foregrounds 20th century working class narratives in all her research. Her first book, Workers in the Margins, Union Radicals in Post-War New Zealand, drew on case studies of the unions of freezing workers, clerical workers, and unemployed workers to explore how women, Māori and Pacific workers, transformed union cultures. A Pākehā historian, Sibel is a senior lecturer in the history program at Te Heringa Waka, Victoria University of Wellington. She's active in her trade union, and she is also a very hard worker. Sibel and I are both oral historians. We work together on the Labour History Project Committee, a group of volunteers who try to ensure workers' histories are not lost, and I see members past and present here today. Sibel's passionate about this work, but she's also been doing social justice work, other social justice work, for a long time, continuing to do this alongside her scholarship, including being active in work for the living wage movement here in Te Whanganui Ātara. Very recently, she helped organise a symposium on the cost of living, which invited a range of historians, veteran activists, and younger generations of activists into conversation to try and work out how success and failures of the past might inform the current moment. That kōrero will be the topic of an upcoming bulletin, which Sibel is guest editing. She's also a mum of two. As I say, she's a very hard worker. Sibel's recently published biography of Bill Anderson Comrade examines labour activism, communism, and social change from the 1930s until the turn of the 21st century. When I first heard Sibel was going to be writing about Bill Anderson, I wondered why Bill in particular. But reading this fascinating story, if you haven't yet, it's available from all good bookshops. It includes oral history recorded by Sibel herself. This will eventually be offered to the archive here at ATL. We learn of a deep and rich worker's story. Bill's early life as a seafarer, the injustice he witnessed, which led him to active involvement in his union, in turn leading to his learning about Māori workers' struggles with racism in their workplaces. As an organiser at the Drivers' Union, Bill was involved with the struggle at Takapara Whau Bastion Point through his relationships with Ngāti Whātua or Ōrake. Sid Keeper was also a close ally. There's so much more than that to learn from this tale of Pākehā and Māori, Pacific peoples, workers of Aotearoa trying to win a fairer and healthier working life through collective action. Biography can offer a window into a time and movement through one individual, which can in turn lead to wider stories of communities and struggles. This work does this in spades. It also offers the opportunity to hear someone's unique voice. For example, I was delighted to see that Bill had written in his unfinished memoir, "A unionist or union leader can be as militant as a bull with a bum full of pepper, but unless he or she understands the laws of development of society and the need for a socialist strategy, then she or he will not be in a position to take the struggle all the way." I had never heard that phrase before, but I've tried to use it quite often since. I think that gives you a certain sense of the flavour of Bill's language in the best possible way. It certainly stopped me in my tracks. Engari, nau e whatu te kākahu, he tāne ko taku. I'm just here to tau toko you, Sibel. This is your work and your time to showcase your whakaaro. So please welcome Sibel Locke, who in this talk offers possibilities for how Bill Anderson's communist working class life might speak to us in the current moment.
Kia ora, Emma Jean. Tēnā koutou katoa, ko tēnei mihi mai wā ki a koutou kua tai mai nei. He mihi nui ki te mana whenua, ko te atiawa me taranaki whānui tai atu ki Ngāti Tō Rangatira. Ko ai au, ai, ko Pāhea hau, no Airani, no Ingarangi, no Kotarangi o Kutupuna. No reira, tēnā koutou, tēnā tātou katoa. So I actually want to begin in the current moment, which is a little bit scary for a historian, but please bear with me. I also want to showcase my president, my union president. The last few years have not been easy. The COVID pandemic and the cost of living crisis have hit us all in different ways, depending on our circumstances. In the university education sector, our already high workloads have been intensified as we all move to dual delivery education systems, teaching and supporting students simultaneously online and in person with very little resourcing. Students were already struggling on unlivable student loans and allowances and worked long hours to be able to study. Real full-time students are only those with the wealth to enable it. COVID brought further income insecurity for students. Stress and fear as the death toll mounted from COVID, and it began to include our friends and our relations. Academic staff like myself have weathered the cost of living crisis okay, but general staff on low wages are increasingly stressed through this cost of living crisis. Through this period, our Vice-Chancellor wailed about the lack of international students, then later threatened us with job cuts if enough of us didn't take redundancy. About 200 people from my workplace did so. And stress levels rose again as people worked harder to fill the gaps that they'd left behind. A wage and a hiring freeze was instituted. At the end of 2021, our university announced a budget surplus. In early 2022, our university refocused on face-to-face teaching to reinvigorate, to rejuvenate our campus, they advocated. No plan was put in place for Omicron. The first day of classes, hundreds of students in the hall had COVID, but the academic staff weren't told. A journalist broke the story. At the same time, COVID was spreading through my kids' school. COVID deniers and their alt-right supporters occupied Parliament and the surrounds, closing the Pipitea campus to staff and students, and of course, this very building. Already exhausted, each of us found ways to keep teaching, supporting our students through this time. Safe to say that people at my workplace were miserable. One place where I found solace during this time was my branch of the Tertiary Education Union. This policy here was put out during the first lockdown, and it became an absolute touchstone that I'd go back to time and time again.
Kia ora, listeners. Quick bit of information for you. At this point, Sibel is displaying a slide with the heading Working Remote, COVID-19 Principles. Underneath is a list of six principles that are: 1. You are not working from home. You are at your home during a crisis trying to work. 2. Your personal, physical, mental and emotional health is far more important than anything else right now. 3. You should not try to compensate for lost productivity by working longer hours. 4. You will be kind to yourself and not judge how you are coping based on how you see others coping. 5, you will be kind to others and not judge how they are coping based on how you are coping. 6, your team success will not be measured the same way it was when things were normal. Underneath this list, it says, "These are extraordinary times," and has the hashtags Afiatu, Afimai and COVID-19 and the logo for the Tertiary Education Union, Te Hautu Kahurangi. Over and out.
Union members came together on Zoom and we shared our experiences. We had a good old moan about our misery. Decided what to do collectively to make things better. Every university branch of our union has a separate collective agreement with their particular employer, our vice chancellors and other senior leadership teams. For the first time in 10 years, universities were all up for bargaining those collective agreements at the same time. So we decided to run a national campaign on the same demands. Strike laws do not allow us to take strike action in solidarity with another university's action, but at least we could organise and take action at the same time in this rare circumstance. Our employers made insulting offers in collective bargaining, pay cuts, really, given inflation, and union members held meetings simultaneously on every campus to decide what to do. We all voted to strike and to do so at the same time. I hadn't seen people smile and laugh so much as those strike actions we took in October last year. There is a fierce joy to be found in standing shoulder to shoulder with workmates, simultaneously downing tools, you know, that pen, walking away from those computers, gathering together in a public place to state, to sing, to chant our grievances, our demands. We are together in this, withdrawing our labour, bringing our workplaces to a standstill. But there are also, as Gordon Anderson writes, severe limitations to our right to strike. It is illegal for us to strike in solidarity with our tutors because they are on a different collective contract. At Vic, we ended up settling our collective contract for less than we wanted because we're offered a pathway for our tutors to join us on the same collective contract. And our tutors were offered a small pay rise for the first time in 3 years. We look forward to legally being able to take industrial action alongside our tutors. Now, it was illegal for us to take further action with our colleagues at other universities who didn't settle and continue to strike during this time. And of course, so many other workers have been taking strike of late in construction, hospitality, horticulture, manufacturing, health, firefighting, and of course, most recently, education. And on similar issues, right? Wages not keeping up with the cost of living, staff shortages, wearing workers thin. Yet, it is illegal for university workers to take strike action in support of these other workers, to walk off the job and support our kids when they walk out of school, demanding urgent action on climate change. It's illegal to walk off the job without notice before our collective agreement expires. If we do any of these things, employers have the right to seek substantial damages from unions and union members. So these are real roadblocks to solidarity. So I want to turn now to the much more comfortable past. And ask how solidarity building and strike actions of the Northern Drivers Union, led by Bill Anderson, might speak to us in this current moment. Comrade, as Emma Jean said, is about Bill Anderson's communist working class trade union Pākehā life. But that life was always embedded in collectivism. Comrade is indeed a book of many voices, and so is this talk today. So I'm taking you back to a time when it was the law that anyone joining a private sector workforce had to join the appropriate trade union. It was never this way for state workers, however. Joining the Public Service Association or the Post-Primary Teachers Association and so forth was always voluntary. And every occupation had a collective agreement covering wages and conditions negotiated regularly between representatives of trade unions and employers supported and enforced by the arbitration system, by the state. The arbitration court regularly assessed economic conditions, the cost of living, and set minimum wages for occupations within its jurisdiction. Unions who registered with the arbitration system gave up the right to strike. Now, compulsory union membership did give private sector trade unions a really stable financial base, but not necessarily active members. Often trade union members knew little about their rights under the arbitration system and what their trade unions were doing for them on their behalf. But some unions did have very active memberships: waterside workers, freezing workers, labourers, railway workers and drivers. Frustrated by the very low wages that were set and limited by this arbitration system, they drew on different kinds of strike action, work stoppages, go slows, you know, taking your time, right, refusing overtime and so forth, to enforce better conversations at the bargaining table with employers. They did so despite strikes being illegal in New Zealand. Gordon Harold Anderson, better known as Bill, was a merchant seaman during the Second World War and suffered exploitative shipboard conditions. By the time he returned home in 1946 from war, aged 22, he was a committed communist and he hated racism. Bill's anti-racism emerged from witnessing the treatment of colonised Arab dock workers in British ports like Aden. Back in Auckland, Bill was nurtured by strong friendships with older maritime trade union leaders, communists, who set an example of united front communism. They built democratic, industrially militant union cultures, practicing international working class solidarity, and they understood the solidarity building as a key step on the long road to socialism. Now, this kind of membership-led militant trade unionism became increasingly difficult from 1948. Cold War anti-communist rhetoric was unleashed by the Labour government of the day and the Federation of Labour, the peak body of private sector trade unions. And it was continued by the national government when it was elected into power in 1950. Trade union militants were demonised as a communist threat to national and international economic and political interests. And as a result, Bill was blacklisted from seafaring, freezing work, and finally waterfront work in 1951. The 1951 waterfront lockout began in February, and after 5 months, ended in defeat. So Bill was amongst about 200 ex-waterside workers in Auckland who became truck, bus, ambulance, taxi, or construction vehicle drivers, and of course joined the Northern Drivers Union. They brought their beliefs in membership-led militant trade unionism with them. So that union was about 5,000 members at the time, grew to about 6,000 members, and it covered Northland, Auckland, Waikato, and the Bay of Plenty regions. And many of them were Māori. Interviewees estimate at about 50% of the union by 1970. Bill was elected an organiser in 1954, secretary of the Northern Drivers Union in 1956. And true to his communist philosophy, he set about democratising the Northern Drivers Union. Delegates were to be elected on every work site with 20 workers or more. And Bill wrote a manual on how to be a good trade union delegate. He wrote, "Fully take into account the ideas and mood of the workers on the job. Look out for that key point of agreement, the issue that most people care about and can unify around. That is the issue to go ahead on." So crucial to active unionism was the ability of union delegates to listen, to provide spaces where issues workers most cared about could be discussed and actions planned. Regular union newspapers informed members about the concerns that were raised and kept these conversations going. Other ex-waterside workers ceded membership, led trade unionism during this time as well, during the 1950s. And Bill's delegate manual became a tool for delegate education through the 1960s. New leaders arose in the Federation of Labour, and in 1960, the Federation of Labour conference agreed to push for the legal right to stop work meetings, like meetings on the job where workers could discuss issues of the day. The Northern Drivers Union built solidarity with other like-minded unions, sharing office space, coordinating activities across the Northern region through the trades councils and, of course, nationally through the Federation of Labour. So as the Northern Drivers Union delegate system expanded across the workforce, Māori drivers became increasingly involved in union affairs. They made their Pākehā union officials aware of incidences of racial discrimination that they faced in the workforce, and it became part of organisers' work to go and get them reinstated. From 1958, annual delegate conferences were set up every year and provided really lively forums that brought all of the delegates together to talk about issues. As South Auckland driver Neil Chapman told me, drivers gathered to grapple with the question of racism, women's rights, workers' rights, world peace. It was not just about paying conditions, but the betterment of mankind, global issues, he said. General Foods driver Ramika Harris reflected, "The Northern Drivers Union was one of the most democratic unions I've ever worked with. We're against racism. We supported the Māori movement." So what was going on? Well, incensed by the New Zealand Rugby Football Union's racist discrimination when selecting teams to tour South Africa, drivers took part in the 1959 No Māori's No Tour campaign. And in May 1960, when peaceful demonstrators in Sharpeville were shot down by police and press, this brought home the reality to places like New Zealand of South African apartheid. Northern Drivers' anti-apartheid support, I think, can be traced from this moment. Bill reported, "Shootings, beatings, and mass punishments of coloured South African workers have motivated a strong protest from this union," and went on to say, "The Northern Drivers Union is firmly opposed to the colour bar. We recognise that New Zealand is not completely free of guilt in this regard. We support the New Zealand Federation of Labour's protest in the matter and urge the government to use every opportunity to speak up boldly against the actions of the South African government regarding the apartheid policy." The Federation of Labour did call on the government to cancel that 1960 tour. The Seafarers Union went further, stopping work for 24 hours to protest that massacre in Sharpeville. Prime Minister Walter Nash refused to intervene, leaving the decision to the New Zealand Rugby Football Union. Despite demonstrations at the time, the tour went ahead. But in that year, just under 60 delegates, about 59, I think, gathered at their annual delegates conference and discussed racial discrimination. It was there that delegates unanimously agreed to the union executives' proposed stand against racial discrimination wherever it may raise its ugly head. Bill reported, "Racial discrimination has the effect of dividing the working people, and we should be united irrespective of colour, religion, or political beliefs." Northern Drivers Union members recognised that a colour bar existed to some extent in New Zealand, and it must be vigorously stamped out, root and branch. So this policy that was agreed to made the Northern Drivers Union an explicitly anti-racist union, and is significant given in 1960, this was the time kind of the mainstream Pākehā beliefs that New Zealand was a place of racial harmony. So through the 1960s, drivers took part in a boycott of South African goods. They also supported the work of Citizens Association for Racial Equality, CARE, formed in 1964, not only to focus on race relations in South Africa, but racism experienced by Māori and Pacific Island migrants to Auckland City. Māori MP Matu Rata was vocal in his opposition to apartheid and came and spoke at a driver's delegate convention in 1966, speaking out against racial discrimination. This time there was success. The planned 1967 All Blacks tour of South Africa was cancelled. The South African Prime Minister, John Vorster, a cunning person, I have to say, adapted the rules so Māori and Pacific Island players could now be included in the All Black touring team as honorary whites. In response, CARE hosted Dennis Brutus, president of the South African Non-Racial Olympic Committee, to strengthen their campaign against sporting contacts with South Africa. And in 1969, Brutus spoke at the Auckland Town Hall, arguing the tour would demonstrate New Zealand's approval of apartheid laws. Northern Drivers executive member Wally Foster, a Māori South Auckland council driver, found Brutus to be a persuasive speaker. Now, Foster had been involved in Māori land rights struggles and educated those around him. Chapman remembered he was a great reader of New Zealand history, and he'd share those stories about land confiscation. So, and also Foster was quite active during this time with Bill in challenging racist hiring practices that were going on in Pukekohe. foster educated drivers in the road transport workers on why they should oppose the 1970 tour. He wrote, "Each year at the annual convention of the Northern Drivers' Union, when race relations are being discussed, the delegates have always adopted a policy which has condemned racial discrimination, racial prejudice, or racial disharmony. This is a very important part of our discussion of our annual conventions for the reason that Pākehās, Māoris, Islanders, and others work side by side, engage at times in conflict with employers side by side, and go home at night to live in their communities side by side. Racial harmony is a question of bread and butter for all working people here in New Zealand. Every worker, be he Pākehā, Māori or Islander, has problems of a similar nature. For example, housing, making the wage packet spin out, feeding the family and sending children to school. These problems cannot be solved by allowing arguments over race or religion to divide us." So Foster presented this idea of opposing sporting contacts with apartheid South Africa as solidarity work to promote racial harmony of the working class, both domestically and internationally. Class identity was also central to Te Rarawa ambulance driver, John Willis, who was elected organizer and vice president of the union at about this time. But these debates continued into the 70s, around in 1970 and 1973 about these tours going to South Africa. And there were fiery affairs, right? There were big fiery debates. All sorts of opinions were expressed. Some drivers argued we shouldn't drag politics into sport. The All Blacks could set South Africans a good example with a mixed race team. Māori play separately from Pākehā internationally sometimes. Isn't this racial discrimination? Other members said, why should we care? We're rugby league supporters. No league teams have contact with South Africa. Most interesting at this time, some drivers argued the union shouldn't be so focused on apartheid in South Africa until it had sorted out its own backyard. Let's look to our own backyard, they argued. So whilst the Northern Drivers Union executive were unified on their opposition to sporting contacts with South Africa, the members were not, and they didn't win the majority position. And so it was students forming Halt All Racist Tours, including Sir Jackson up there, who took the lead in the 1970s New Zealand anti-apartheid movement. But taking direction from their members, the Northern Drivers executive decided to focus indeed on local racism issues. Radical protest groups Ngā Tamatō and the Polynesian Panthers had emerged in inner city Auckland, simultaneously influenced by local conditions and transnational Black Power movements. They campaigned to save Te Reo Māori, draw attention to the broken promises of the Treaty of Waitangi, institutional racism. The Polynesian Panthers were protesting the racist dawn raids that targeted Pacifica peoples in their homes and on the streets. And they were also part of this broader anti-Vietnam War and anti-apartheid movements happening at the time. So Ngā Tamatō leader, Hannah Jackson, Hannah Te Himara, she's more widely known today, she came and addressed an Auckland stop work meeting of the drivers to explain the work that Ngā Tamatō was doing in late 1973. And so after, you know, listening to her and having another lively debate, they all voted to give $100 towards Ngā Tamatō to continue this work. And then after that time, there's a range of articles that were published in the Road Transport Worker supporting the work and as a result generated support from drivers for the Māori Land March in 1975. Now, all of these debates that were going on took place at legal stop work meetings, a condition that drivers had won from employers by using illegal strike action. Okay, so how did this happen? Well, the arbitration court failed to deliver wage increases that kept up with the cost of living in 1968. It delivered a nil wage order, which was basically a wage cut for the entire workforce. And as a result, all of the union delegates came together in the Federation of Labour special conference they held and endorsed using direct bargaining, industrial action with employers. They were so let down with the system, they lost their faith in it. It made a collective decision to start using industrial action right across the board. So it was in this new kind of environment that the drivers' union increased its targeted strike action, focusing on particular employers who are part of the export economy, and gained the best results they ever had. In the 1969 collective agreement, they won a wage rise, long service bonuses, trailer rates, 5 days of sick leave per year, and those two stop work meetings that I talked about. Up until that point, wages were below the average for drivers, pretty low, and kept that way in the arbitration system. But for the first time in 1969, the wage that they gained as their minimum for general drivers was just above the average wage. Petrol, beer, cement and refrigerator drivers took strike action in 1970 and weathered threats of deregistration from the arbitration system. Bill Anderson was very careful in the way strike action was conducted. He said, analyse a dispute with members, devise a clear strategy and the tactics to get there, know when to fight, when to advance and when to retreat. Always settle at the peak of a dispute to preserve your organisational capacity, right? Keep everyone with you. And at the same time, other trade unions were taking industrial action as well. And all of these issues that were coming up were being discussed at monthly Auckland Trades Council meetings where every union was represented. And at the same time, state sector unions were becoming increasingly radicalised as well. It was in this new industrial reality that the Labor government passed the Industrial Relations Act of 1973, which established a dual system that trade unions were now allowed to they could continue to negotiate collective agreements through that arbitration system, and they could engage in direct industrial action to win settlements that were outside and on top of those collective agreements. So most significantly, the Act partially repealed sanctions for strikes relating to disputes of interest, so thus permitting some strikes to occur legally. However, common law injunctions could still be used by employers to bring strikes to an end, and Bill Anderson became the target of such an injunction in 1974. The Northern Drivers' Union had committed to a solidarity strike with the Seafarers' Union. The North Shore Transport Company manager, Leo Dromgoole, had sacked all the crew on one of the Auckland Waiheke ferries. It was over a wage dispute, and so drivers agreed to stop delivering fuel to their company. So what did Dromgoole do now that some strikes were legal? He went off to gain a common law injunction to force people back to work. However, the drivers and the seafarers' unions both ignored the injunction. They knew they had the backing of the Federation of Labour and the Labour Party annual conference, which had condemned the use of injunctions against unions. So Dromgoole then applied to have the government seize the assets of both the seafarers and the Northern Drivers' unions and arrest their union secretaries. Interesting, they left the seafarers alone. But Justice Peter Mahon ordered Bill Anderson's arrest, and he was taken to Mount Eden Prison on the 1st of July 1974. Word spread. The following day, 20,000 Auckland industrial workers downed tools and walked off the job. It's estimated that Auckland lost 1.6 million in profits that day. Prime Minister Norman Kirk was so concerned that Auckland anti-injunction strikes would spread nationwide, he prepared to call a state of emergency and bring in the army. Hasty negotiations occurred inside Mount Eden with the minister concerned, head of the Federation of Labour, and a Supreme Court hearing was organised for the following day. Nearly 10,000 people gathered to support Bill outside that court. Inside, it was agreed that both unions were to lift their bans if court injunctions were dropped, and Dromgoole agreed to sell his company. These things came to pass. Now, the drivers' union understood that the Labour government had also agreed to change the law so that court-imposed injunctions could no longer be used to end industrial disputes in the future, but this did not eventuate. Now, the National Party, led by Robert Muldoon, was elected into government in 1975. Muldoon was anti-union, anti-communist, scratched every itch of prejudice against the poor, particularly the brown poor. And in the face of rising inflation, National cut spending, instituted a wage freeze, and amended the law limiting trade union industrial activity and making it illegal to protest government policy. However, determined to defend a decent standard of living, trade unions continue to coordinate industrial action to break the freeze. They also took industrial action when US and British nuclear-armed and powered ships visited New Zealand. They supported actions around the environment, around Māori land rights as well. So Muldoon announced that 24 hectares at Takaparawhau Bastion Point on the Auckland waterfront would be subdivided, sold off, and redeveloped as a pricey retirement village. Ngāti Whātua Ōrākei were outraged. Takaparawhau was Ngāti Whātua Ōrākei land that had been taken by stealth and force over the years, and now it would be developed even further out of reach. A delegation from the Ōrākei Māori Action Committee came to the Auckland Trades Council, chaired by Bill Anderson, and made a case for a green ban on Bastion Point. That is a ban on any work for that planned redevelopment. And Auckland Trades Union Trades Council delegates all agreed. Truck driver Sid Kepper remembered, Muldoon wanted to build rich people's houses on there. So that was a big draw card. Not only for me, but some were a bit iffy on Māori rights anyway. I was going up to support the people at Takaparawhau, get the rich white people out. I don't think there was anything in it about supporting Māori rights. I think that's how the Auckland Trades Council sold it to the membership. It was about poor people against rich people, which I thought was a brilliant way of doing things, rather than to say it was Māori land and it's there. So the whole Auckland Trades Council agreed to put the green ban on. On the 4th of January 1977, Joe Hawke and the Ōrākei Māori Committee Action Group began an occupation of Takaparawhau that would last for... They're demanding grievances, justice for their grievances, and the occupation lasted 17 months. Trade unionists supported the occupation in different kinds of practical ways. They continued education on Māori land rights issues at stake in union newspapers and organised job site meetings of those workers most concerned, you know, that might be called on to do that development work to ensure that the green ban stayed on. Māori workers were deeply involved in these efforts. So while the green ban was initially sold to trade union members as a class issue, during this occupation, conversations inside trade unions became focused on Māori land rights and the history of colonisation. For example, Bill stated, all the jokes about the Pākehā stealing Māori land are almost correct. The Pākehās who have stolen, legally on some occasions, Māori land were not drivers, storemen, labourers or carpenters. It was the stock and station companies and other carpet baggers. There's the rich Pākehās or the agents. Many of our union members and our union members are amongst those who have been or are being robbed. The Great Māori Land March and the Bastion Point Struggle represent the first real rollback in this long and infamous period of injustice against the Māori peoples. Sadly, that injustice continued. On the 25th of May 1978, 700 police and army personnel invaded Bastion Point. The military cordoned the land by a human ring of police officers. They removed 222 people, charging them with willful trespass. So this was a terrible, terrible day. But the Auckland trade union members ensured that green ban stayed in place for as long as Ngāti Whātua needed it to be in place. Bill, the Northern Drivers Union, and other trade unionists, I argue, learned much from this occupation. What was initially interpreted as a class issue over time was understood in relation to Māori land rights and colonisation. And Māori drivers, in solidarity with other Māori workers, played increasingly prominent roles in their unions during this time, some of the most significant strikes in the late 1970s. Now, the national government continued to blame the rising cost of living on wage increases. Does that sound familiar? And also increasingly intervened in wage bargaining to try and drive those wage negotiations down. Workers were already struggling, and they in turn pointed the finger at businesses who were upping their prices to increase their profits. This was causing inflation, they argued. And in September 1979, for the first time, private sector and state sector unions came together in a one-day national strike to bring an end to government interference in direct bargaining. Around about 300,000 workers across the country stopped work, and it worked. The government backed down, and later that hated Remuneration Act that was being used to interfere with bargaining was repealed. Toby Borumen, called it Toby, calculates that 46% of the workforce took part in work stoppages during this time, in a large part due to this general strike. And for Bill, this was the high point of the trade union movement. So I thought I would end on this high note. Let's stop now. So how does this history speak to me? I couldn't possibly talk for any of you. So this is just what it's saying to me right now. It reminds me of the really important role that union delegates can play. Those people at the grassroots who organize time and space where we can come together, listen to each other, moan, gossip, have a laugh, share the issues that we're deeply concerned about, have those hard conversations about the different kinds of discrimination that we face in our workplaces and our communities. A delegate who also pushes us to unify around a particular issue that we most care about, one that we're prepared to take action together on, and to network all of those delegate-led grassroots conversations, building solidarity on that key issue, outwards and outwards through our unions, community groups, until we have such a critical mass of people with us that we're not afraid to break those strike laws that pin us in. Kia ora.
We have time for some questions.
Thanks very much, Sibyl. Wonderful work. Of course, the big debate of the times was the impact of the arbitration court. There was the unions who, the large part of the union movement was in it, but constant debate whether it was actually the legal irons of labour or assistance, and the debate over whether it held people back or not. Mm. And then there was those various changes to the law that came about. I'm just wondering what your assessment of those different institutions is reflecting on this work that you've done.
I mean, Bill was always of the mind, Bill Anderson was always of the mind that workers need to use their own collective power. But even though he said that, the way that he engaged other workers around him to use industrial activity was always in conjunction with that arbitration system, that you could, that wielding both ways, you could get the best for everybody. So in some ways, I think he really had a leg in both camps, that it really wasn't for an either or, that we either just need to let go of that shackle, that arbitration court, and we lose the right to strike, or we just stay within its parameters. Yeah.
Did Bill retain his communist beliefs, particularly after 1956, when I know a lot of people did leave the party?
Yes. Bill remained a communist until the day he died. He maintained a real faith in the Soviet Union, despite everything, right up until the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And by that stage, what he saw was that the leadership of the Communist Party in the Soviet Union had been corrupt, removed from the people. But for him, the Marxist-Leninist principles were still true. And so he held to those for the rest of his days. Yeah. Kia ora.
Can I come back to the present?
Sure.
One of my daughters has a senior position, nursing position in a local hospital. Last week she resigned and is going to a much less well-paid job in the private sector.
Mm.
Three of her colleagues that she told ended up crying, and one of them indicated she wished she had the courage to resign as well. How do you think collective bargaining will resolve the issues that they're obviously going through in the health sector?
Ooh, you're asking a historian about the current moment and about a union that I don't belong to. Goodness. I guess what I'm thinking is that there's no one answer, right? There's a whole lot of things that need to be done to address the fact that we're overworked, which I'm presuming is a big part of the reason for the change of job. So why isn't it that that the government, that our taxes support the, you know, fully and living allowances for anyone training in the health sector, all of those kinds of things. Whether we can necessarily achieve that through just a union and the laws that are available that way is a different question. All right, that's my very uncomfortable answer.
In 1971, I worked in the office of the Seamen's Union for a few months as their office girl. And Pinsir Martin and Les Barber gave me quite a insight into unionism. And one of the things I found really interesting was that one of my jobs was to draw up the list of seamen to work on the ships that were in Wellington Harbour, because they had a union hiring hall. And it wasn't until I got to the United States that I learned how many places had union hiring halls. But one of my jobs was when a seaman came in and wanted to get a new ticket, you would go through the log, an enormous book, and every strike was noted over the years, and every seaman union member's name was there. And if they had scabbed on any strike, they got no job. So they ran it. But the hiring hall was extremely important, because what it meant was that when a seaman came in to register that they were available for a job, they got first in, first serve. So if you're an able seaman and they needed one, the employer had no opportunity whatsoever to say, I ain't having that militant sod on the ship. We need that sort of thing returned. But what I'd like to really ask, we've got all this history, these fights, this whole thing of political discussions within unions. We don't have them today. We have bread and butter, wage, conditions, all the rest is out. And in the Employment Contracts Act, there were some of us who actually pushed resolutions, 1-1, I lost by 3 votes in my union, for us to go out on strike. And there was no fight back. Real united fight back, which is why today we have low wages, poor in conditions. So that's it.
Hilda.
I think that's a great place to close. If we can thank you all, and thank you for the questions and comments, and just wrap up with a big thank you to Sibel.
Thanks for listening to this New Zealand History podcast from Manatū Taonga. Don't forget to subscribe. And if you're looking for other content about New Zealand history, check out earlier talks in the series. You can find them on your favourite podcast channels. Just search for New Zealand History. Mā te wā!